Warren Buffett's journey from an Omaha boy with a knack for numbers to becoming one of the world's wealthiest individuals is more than just a tale of financial success. It's a masterclass in patience, discipline, and ethical capitalism. Tap Dancing to Work, compiled by Carol Loomis, Buffett's close friend of over 40 years and editor of his shareholder letters, offers an unparalleled chronological view of Buffett's evolution as an investor and thinker. The book has become required reading in business schools worldwide and counts Bill Gates among its most vocal admirers. What makes this collection particularly fascinating is how it captures Buffett's consistency of thought alongside his willingness to adapt. From his early days as a Benjamin Graham disciple to his transformation into a business owner seeking wonderful companies at fair prices, we witness the development of an investment philosophy that has created more wealth than perhaps any other in modern history. Warren Buffett's investment journey began long before most people knew his name. In 1966, when Fortune magazine first mentioned him, misspelling his name as Buffet, he was running a $45 million operation in Omaha that used hedge fund principles, to some extent, but focused on long-term investment. By 1970, his partnership had grown to $100 million and delivered exceptional returns, 23.8% compounded annually over 13 years for limited partners, crushing the Dow's 7.4% during the same period. What's remarkable is that at the height of his success, Buffett made a decision that puzzled many. He closed his partnership. At 39, having accumulated about $25 million personally, he felt disconnected from the speculative market, famously stating, "This is a market I don't understand." He believed making money in stocks would become harder, though this prediction proved only temporarily accurate. Rather than pursuing other interests as he had suggested, Buffett continued investing through Berkshire Hathaway, a struggling textile manufacturer he had acquired. This seemingly modest vehicle would become his canvas for creating one of history's greatest investment masterpieces. Through Berkshire, Buffett began assembling a collection of businesses and stock holdings that would generate extraordinary returns for decades. His approach was methodical and disciplined. Unlike conventional corporate reports with glossy photos and colorful graphics, Berkshire's annual reports were plain, but contained Buffett's intellectually rich, humorous, and uniquely personal chairman's letters. These missives grew longer each year and began attracting attention far beyond Berkshire shareholders. What distinguished them was their remarkable candor about mistakes and failures. While most chairman's letters emphasized positive developments, Buffett highlighted negatives, openly discussing poor textile business performance and acknowledging Berkshire's impressive growth would inevitably diminish. This transparency, combined with his exceptional investment results, gradually transformed Buffett from an obscure Midwestern investor into the Oracle of Omaha, a figure whose every market move and utterance would eventually be scrutinized worldwide. At the heart of Buffett's approach lies a deceptively simple principle. Treat stocks as ownership interests in businesses rather than pieces of paper to be traded. This perspective, inherited from his mentor Benjamin Graham but evolved significantly, has guided his decisions for decades. Buffett's investment philosophy centers on finding good businesses, operations with strong franchises, above-average returns on equity, minimal capital requirements, and cash-generating ability. He seeks these qualities whether buying whole companies or stock portions, and is patient in waiting for opportunities at reasonable prices. What separates Buffett from most investors is his willingness to act decisively when opportunities arise, yet remain completely inactive when conditions aren't favorable. As he once explained, investing doesn't require many good ideas, just a few excellent ones, comparing it to having only 20 investment punches in your career. This patience is exemplified in his approach to market volatility, which he sees not as risk but as opportunity. While academics define risk as relative volatility, beta, Buffett defines it simply as the possibility of loss or injury. He argues that portfolio concentration may actually decrease risk by increasing the intensity with which an investor thinks about a business and the comfort level needed before buying. True investors, in his view, welcome volatility because it creates irrationally low prices for solid businesses. How can such opportunities increase hazard for investors free to either ignore the market or exploit its folly? Buffett's contrarian streak has been evident throughout his career. When he purchased $139 million in bonds from the Washington Public Power Supply System, nicknamed WHOOPS after its notorious $2.25 billion default, he secured an attractive 16.3% tax-free yield by buying when prices had plummeted due to the crisis. His analysis was characteristically independent. "We don't make judgments based on ratings. We read. That's about it." Perhaps most importantly, Buffett recognizes that investing success requires emotional discipline. As he explains, "You're neither right nor wrong because others agree with you. You're right because your facts and reasoning are right." This independence of thought has allowed him to avoid countless investment fads and bubbles over the decades, including the late 1990s tech boom that many claimed had rendered his approach obsolete. What truly distinguishes Buffett from other great investors is his creation of Berkshire Hathaway, a unique corporate structure that combines insurance operations, wholly owned businesses, and stock investments into a wealth-generating machine unlike any other. At Berkshire's core is property casualty insurance that generates investment float, premiums collected up front that can be invested before claims must be paid. Beyond this are Buffett's collection of wholly owned businesses, which he calls his Sainted Seven, and other acquisitions. The Buffalo News, Fetchheimer Brothers, Uniforms, Nebraska Furniture Mart, See's Candies, and various Scott and Fetzer operations. These businesses collectively earn exceptional returns, in some years as high as 57% after tax on equity. Buffett's hands-off management approach gives operating heads complete freedom while he focuses solely on capital allocation, pricing decisions, and financial analysis. He sets compensation for top executives through uncapped incentive plans tailored to specific business objectives while drawing only $100,000 himself. Though geographically dispersed and unfamiliar with each other, his managers can freely consult him for business advice. This decentralized approach stands in stark contrast to typical conglomerates. Berkshire's operating companies function independently without company-wide meetings or mandated systems. Some use detailed budgets and strategic plans, while others simply review mail together each morning. Recent acquisitions appreciate Buffett's lack of bureaucracy and quick decision-making, with one CEO noting it's the next best thing to owning the company himself. Buffett's reputation as an ideal owner gives him an edge in acquisitions. He promises independence to management and delivers, creating a refuge for family businesses and public companies seeking escape from market pressures. His 2000 buying spree was aided by tightening financial conditions that limited competition. The Johns Manville acquisition exemplifies this. When another buyer's deal collapsed, Buffett swooped in with $2.2 billion cash and closed the deal in 24 hours. At Berkshire's lean 11-person headquarters in Omaha, Buffett leads an unhurried, largely unscheduled life. He spends hours reading, talking on the phone, and meticulously crafting his famous annual report. His exceptional intelligence creates what his partner Charlie Munger calls constant mental pressure for those working directly with him, with one insurance head wondering, "How do you ever think much of your own abilities after being around Warren Buffett?" While Buffett is often portrayed as a solo genius, his success has been significantly enhanced by key partnerships, most notably with Charlie Munger, his intellectual foil and Berkshire's vice chairman. Munger, a former lawyer with a sharp analytical mind, has been Buffett's sounding board for decades. Their annual meeting follows a choreographed format where Buffett answers questions at length before turning to Munger, who either makes pithy, often scathing comments or simply says, "I have nothing to add." Munger has become increasingly outspoken over the years, blasting auditors as contemptible, calling corrupt foreign governments kleptocracies, and declaring Wall Street filled with racetrack touts. Beyond his sharp critiques, Munger demonstrates profound wisdom through statements like, "We have a high moral responsibility to be rational," and "You don't really have a competency if you don't know the edge of it." His influence on Buffett has been substantial, helping evolve Buffett's approach from Graham's strict value formulas toward an emphasis on business quality. Beyond Munger, Buffett has cultivated strategic relationships with other business leaders. His friendship with Thomas Murphy of Capital City/ABC led to one of Berkshire's most successful investments. The acquisition of American Broadcasting Companies by Capital Cities Communications in 1985, with Berkshire's significant involvement, was an investment Buffett favored from the start. The deal proved highly successful. Capital City/ABC thrived and was eventually acquired by Walt Disney Co. in 1996, with Berkshire more than quadrupling its original investment. Perhaps most surprising was Buffett's friendship with Bill Gates, which began in 1991 when mutual friend Meg Greenfield brought them together. Despite their differences, Buffett, the 64-year-old industrial-age investor in basic businesses, and Gates, the information-age tech mogul, they formed a deep bond. Gates describes how Buffett installs strong managers in Berkshire companies but leaves them alone, letting them focus on their core business while he handles capital allocation. They share values about wealth, both planning to give most of their fortunes to charity rather than passing everything to their children. These relationships reveal an important aspect of Buffett's character, his preference for working with people he likes and trusts. As he once said, "I always worry about people who say, 'I'm going to do this for 10 years. I really don't like it very well. And then I'll do this.' That's a little like saving up sex for your old age. Not a very good idea." He emphasized working with people you admire and avoiding business deals with those who cause your stomach to churn. Throughout his career, Buffett has offered penetrating insights into market behavior and investor psychology. His analysis often cuts through conventional wisdom to reveal deeper truths about how markets function. In his famous 1999 Fortune article on stock market returns, Buffett explained how two critical variables, interest rates and corporate profits, drive market performance. From 1964 to 1981, investors lost confidence in the American economy due to poor profit outlook and sky-high interest rates. The subsequent bull market came from improved profitability and dramatically lower interest rates, eventually fueled by speculative trading. Looking at the entire 20th century, Buffett identified a puzzling disconnect. Despite consistent economic progress, 702% real per capita growth, the market experienced three huge bull markets covering 44 years and three stagnation periods spanning 56 years. During those stagnation periods, the Dow actually lost 292 points despite significant economic advancement. The culprit? Investors' tendency to be guided by the rearview mirror. Buffett illustrated this with Edgar Lawrence Smith's 1924 book that revealed how retained earnings create compound growth in stocks, a revelation that ignited the 1920s bull market until prices became disconnected from value. As Keynes warned, it's dangerous to apply to the future inductive arguments based on past experience without understanding why past results occurred. Buffett criticized pension fund managers who, despite their long time horizons, make the same mistake as amateurs, buying enthusiastically when prices are high and retreating when stocks get cheaper. He compared this to refusing to buy hamburgers when prices fall. In 1979, when stocks were a screaming buy, these managers were still fixated on past market trauma rather than recognizing stocks as disguised bonds trading below par while earning 13% on book value, far superior to the 9.5% available on actual bonds. This contrarian perspective extends to his views on market efficiency. While academics were developing the efficient market hypothesis, EMH, which holds that the stock market cannot be beaten by mere mortals, Buffett's extraordinary investment success posed a direct challenge. Stanford professor William Sharpe described Buffett as a Five Sigma event, Statistically, there was only about one chance in 3.5 million of compiling such an investment record by chance. While Buffett's investment career has been marked by remarkable success, perhaps his greatest leadership test came during the Salomon Brothers Treasury Bond scandal in 1991, a crisis that threatened not just his reputation, but potentially the entire financial system. In 1987, Buffett had made his largest investment ever, $700 million of Berkshire's money into Salomon Preferred Stock. Despite his previous criticisms of investment bankers' greed, Buffett trusted CEO John Gutfreund, whom he'd seen act with integrity at Geico. After the October 1987 crash sent Salomon's stock plummeting from $33 to $16, Wall Street's perception shifted from Buffett having secured a dream security to having bought a bummer. Then came the crisis. On that fateful Sunday at Salomon, Buffett received devastating news. Treasury was barring Salomon from bidding at auctions due to violations in the Treasury bond market. Buffett, Gutfreund, and other executives immediately recognized this would destroy the company, not from economic loss, but because markets would interpret it as Treasury to Salomon, drop dead. With Japanese markets opening within hours and bankruptcy lawyers already summoned, Buffett faced three options: get Treasury to reverse the ban, put on a brave face, quickly rejected as dishonest, or declare bankruptcy. Buffett privately resolved to refuse election as chairman if bankruptcy ensued, knowing this would devastate his reputation. Meanwhile, he frantically worked the phones, reaching Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady at Saratoga Springs. Brady initially couldn't fathom that Buffett would refuse the job or that Salomon's failure would trigger financial contagion, but he kept the dialogue open. The breakthrough came when Fed President Gerald Corrigan joined the calls and took Buffett's warnings seriously. At precisely 2:30 p.m., when Buffett was scheduled to meet the press, Treasury called with a compromise, lifting the ban on Salomon's proprietary trading while maintaining restrictions on customer accounts. "Will that do?" asked Treasury official Jerome Powell, later Federal Reserve Chairman. "I think it will," Buffett replied. The board quickly elected Buffett chairman and Derek Maughan as operating head. At the press conference, when asked how he'd manage being in both New York and Omaha, Buffett quipped, "My mother has sewn my name in my underwear, so it'll be okay." The Treasury's partial reversal paradoxically gave Salomon credibility it couldn't have gained otherwise. After months of reducing leverage and negotiating with banks, Salomon eventually settled its legal troubles for $290 million. By May 1992, with the worst behind them, Buffett returned to Omaha. Looking back, Buffett describes the Salomon investment as a scratch single that came after falling behind 0-2 in the count. His wry comment 2 years after the crisis broke: "Moser's paying $30,000 and is sentenced to prison for 4 months. Salomon shareholders, including me, paid $290 million, and I got sentenced to 10 months as CEO." For much of his career, Buffett was known for his investment prowess rather than his philanthropy. Though he had established a foundation focused on population control and nuclear threat reduction, he had spent relatively little on these causes, just $10 to $15 million by the late 1980s. This changed dramatically in 2006 when Buffett announced his plan to give away 85% of his Berkshire Hathaway fortune, worth over $40 billion. He explained that his wife Susie's death had changed his philanthropic timeline, as they had always assumed she would oversee the distribution of their wealth. The majority of his fortune would go to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, with Buffett joining as a trustee. Buffett devised a precise plan for distributing his fortune. Though he held only Berkshire Hathaway A stock, he'd convert it to B shares at a 30-to-1 ratio for his gifts. He allocated specific numbers of B shares to 5 foundations, giving 5% of the designated shares to each recipient in 2006, then 5% of the remaining shares annually until his death or until certain foundation conditions were no longer met. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation received the largest allocation, 10 million shares, with gifts continuing only as long as either Bill or Melinda remains active in the foundation's work. Other recipients included the Susan Thompson Buffett Foundation, 1 million shares, which focuses on reproductive health and nuclear weapons prevention, and three foundations run by his children, Susan A. Buffett Foundation, 350,000 shares for early education, Howard G. Buffett Foundation, 350,000 shares for conservation and humanitarian projects, and Novo Foundation, 350,000 shares run by Peter Buffett for education and human rights. In his philanthropic pledge, Buffett explained that his wealth comes from living in America, some lucky genes, and compound interest. He acknowledged winning what he calls the ovarian lottery, noting the 30-to-1 odds against his 1930 birth taking place in the U.S., with additional advantages from being male and white. Buffett reflected on America's market system that sometimes produces distorted results, rewarding battlefield heroes with medals and great teachers with thank you notes, while those who detect mispriced securities receive billions. His family's reaction to their fortune was not guilt, but gratitude. He explained their philosophy. Were we to use more than 1% of my claim checks on ourselves, neither our happiness nor our well-being would be enhanced. In contrast, that remaining 99% can have a huge effect on the health and welfare of others. As Warren Buffett entered his ninth decade, his influence extended far beyond investment returns. His straightforward approach to business, ethical stance, and philanthropic commitments have shaped how many view capitalism itself. In post-Enron corporate America, a letter of praise from Warren Buffett became the ultimate seal of approval. Companies proudly displayed Buffett's endorsements of their governance practices or accounting transparency. As one analyst noted, he's the only person or entity out there that still has an unblemished reputation. Buffett's moral authority became so profound that his Washington Post op-ed criticizing dividend tax elimination helped reshape congressional legislation. A Duke University survey revealed that graduating MBAs admired Buffett more than anyone except their fathers, more than presidents, popes, or Gandhi. This unique stature gave him the ability to shape the behavior of people far beyond his direct reach merely through his words, establishing him as American capitalism's unofficial Lord Protector. In 2010, Buffett and the Gateses launched the Giving Pledge, their initiative to encourage billionaires to commit to giving away most of their wealth to charity. The campaign began with a series of private dinners, followed by a public announcement targeting billionaires to pledge at least 50% of their net worth to philanthropy. Starting with the Forbes 400 wealthiest Americans, this initiative could potentially direct $600 billion to charitable causes. By September 2013, 114 people had signed the Giving Pledge, not counting co-signing spouses. The initiative expanded internationally, with Buffett and Gates organizing dinners in India and China to spread the philosophy to countries where dynastic inheritances typically take precedence over philanthropy. Beyond philanthropy, Buffett has used his platform to advocate for gender equality. In a 2013 article, he made a compelling economic and moral case for women's advancement, sharing how he and his equally intelligent sisters were treated differently from birth. He was told the world's opportunities were his to seize, while they were guided toward marrying well. This created a system where my floor became my sister's ceiling. He recounted his relationship with Katharine Graham, the Washington Post CEO, who, despite her brilliance, struggled with self-doubt instilled by societal messaging about women's capabilities. Buffett made a pragmatic appeal. Just as no manager would run plants at 80% efficiency if improvements were possible, America cannot afford to underutilize female talent. Perhaps Buffett's most enduring legacy is his demonstration that exceptional financial success need not come at the expense of integrity, transparency, or human decency. In a business world often characterized by short-termism and ethical compromises, Buffett has shown that patience, honesty, and treating partners fairly can lead to superior long-term results. The ultimate testament to Buffett's approach is in the numbers. When Fortune first mentioned Warren Buffett in 1966, Berkshire stock was about $22. By mid-2013, it had reached $168,600. A $1,000 investment in Berkshire at that 1966 price would have grown to $7,663,636 by mid-2013, a return that has created generational wealth for those who partnered with Buffett early and stayed the course. What makes these results even more remarkable is that they were achieved without excessive risk-taking or leverage. Buffett has always emphasized maintaining conservative financial policies, even at the cost of potentially higher returns through leverage. His focus has been on sustainable growth rather than maximizing short-term profits. Berkshire's performance has beaten the S&P 500 in 32 of Buffett's first 36 years at the helm, a consistency that defies statistical probability. The stock has delivered a 27% annual growth rate over this period, turning every $10,000 invested into millions. Beyond the raw numbers, Buffett's success can be measured in how he navigated major market disruptions. During the 2008 financial crisis, when many financial institutions were collapsing, Berkshire was strong enough to invest $5 billion in Goldman Sachs and $3 billion in General Electric, providing critical capital when it was most needed. Even Buffett's mistakes reveal his exceptional judgment. His worst investment decisions were often not losses, but mistakes of omission. Opportunities he understood but passed on, costing shareholders potentially billions. As he once noted, these missed chances cost him far more than his actual losses. The most impressive aspect of Buffett's record may be its longevity. While many investors have brief periods of outperformance followed by regression to the mean, Buffett has sustained exceptional results across multiple decades, economic cycles, and market environments. This consistency speaks to the fundamental soundness of his approach, focusing on business fundamentals rather than market movements, maintaining emotional discipline when others panic, and thinking independently rather than following the crowd. As Carol Loomis concludes in her final note, the transformation of Berkshire from a struggling textile manufacturer into one of the world's largest companies stands as perhaps the greatest investment story of our time, a testament to the power of patience, discipline, and clear thinking in a world often dominated by short-term perspectives and emotional decision-making.